How do you live your life like tomorrow matters? Perhaps you're already growing food, consuming less, connecting with your community. Perhaps you're already thinking hard, keen to see the world a little slower, greener, healthier. But where to begin? Here on the Future Setting Podcast, we dig deep into the hearts and minds of blissfully normal people doing bloody amazing things, unearthing their moments of contradiction, their hopes and fears for the future, and what galvanises them to action, in the name of inspiring all of us to do a little more in shaping a better future today. I'm Jade, and this is Future Setting. So today's guest is a woman who has galvanised the Future Setting tagline of living like tomorrow matters, and she's written a book called Together We Can, Everyday Australians Doing Amazing Things to Give Our Planet a Future. It sort of sounds fairly similar, so I feel like we're going to have a good old yarn. I'd like to introduce you to Claire Rourke, and while this is her first foray into book publishing, it's absolutely not her first rodeo in talking about how we can all take action around climate change adaptation today, right from where each of us stand. Claire is a mum, she's a behaviour change expert and works for an organisation that when I've got my sustainable table hat on, I often stalk them for ideas and inspiration about bringing systemic change to our world. It's called the Sunrise Project. It's definitely worth checking out. I'll pop the link in the show notes. So Claire, welcome to the Future Setting Podcast.
Oh, it's great to be part of the Future Setting crew. Thanks for having me, Jade.
My pleasure. It's warmer where you are. I can tell just because of the light streaming in behind you. I'm green with envy.
Well, it's very green where I am. So for listeners, it's I'm on Dharawal country, which is just north of Wollongong in the northern Illawarra, and I'm at a place called Ostermere where I'm sitting in my kind of lounge room come workspace, which looks out onto some of the Illawarra Escarpment rainforest that surrounds our home. But also our house is built next to an old mine entrance. So, you know, coal mining and coal history is infused through this area. It's got a new nostalgia for it called the Coal Coast, even though most of the coal mines have closed down. So we've got to live in this really interesting juxtaposition of a like pristine natural world with beaches and escarpment forest. And then we've got a very rich industrial history, you know, building upon the incredible prehistory of this place and the kind of ongoing care for country that First Nations people in this area have, you know, provided despite all the challenges. So it's a really interesting area to live.
Beautiful part of the world. And before I hit the big red button to record, you said very clearly, I'm actually a pretty crap gardener. And I think we might lead off there because I think lots of people that we interview talk about the fact that their time in their garden is their self and it's their nourishing place, and it's actually not for everybody. So let's talk about the fact that there are on-ramps of all different shapes and sizes and that you have a completely different on-ramp to the way you live your life.
Well, don't get me wrong, I do love being in nature and do a lot of bushwalking and, you know, swimming and, you know, enjoying the place that we live in, and we've taken our kids hiking and things like that. My husband's more the gardener in our place. I'm the person who goes, you want that hole dug over there? I'll dig that hole and I'll enjoy it. And then to the pruning and the kind of slow, deliberate daily habits around being in the garden, which I know that maybe in time I will come to. At the moment, I feel like it's just another thing for my already pretty busy, frenetic life. But totally, the book is really covering lots of different stories from people who have kind of hit their moment of realization around climate change being materially important to themselves and the people they hold close, and they see that they need to make a decision to do something. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it often in places that are very close to them, either geographically or it's part of their passion or it's part of their circle of influence. One of the best stories on this in the book is a fantastic woman called Susan Mungall, who's from Kingaroy in Queensland, a couple of hundred clicks kind of west of Brisbane on Waka Waka country. And she had a moment of realization that kind of built up over a while. You know, her son was doing a war on waste at his local primary school, and she was talking to the teachers there, and she was studying a master's in public health. But it was the moment when Greta Thunberg spoke to the UN and, you know, pointed her finger at everyone, was the moment where she felt like Greta was pointing to her. Mm. And, you know, within 18 months, she's processed a whole lot of climate grief and climate distress, but she's kind of fueled that into a decision to do something. And she started a local Eco Mums Facebook group. She is lobbying the South Burnett Council, and she's involved in an organisation called Climate for Change, which runs structured group and one-to-one conversations with people about climate change with a view to helping people catalyse their action. So that's just one small example of someone who had no real engagement in climate, grew up on a farm, you know, was clearing the trees with her family when she was much younger, and then just kind of went through this incredible transformation. And, you know, she's not living in a Canberra political bubble, or, you know, is already ensconced in a whole lot of environmental action. So, you know, you don't have to be a gardener or a, you know, climate scientist, mm-hmm. or, you know, a political type to really realise and catalyse your agency, because it's very influential to be acting within your own networks.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. You just mentioned a second ago that she worked through in 18 month period, she worked through her climate grief. And this is something that we talk about quite a bit, because it's very real, and especially for those who are working in the sphere where it's sort of a, not a black shadow, but it's definitely a shadow that's hanging over you all the time. I would love you to talk a little bit about your experience with what that climate grief has looked like for you, and just, I guess, the mental health impacts of the fact that we're now in a changing and really uncertain world, and what that looks like.
Yeah. So the reason I've written this book was kind of sparked by my own climate grief, or I call it climate freakout, because it just felt like a real moment of shift for me, even though it's not a terribly scientific term.
It's real, and I think that's why it's relatable. Yeah, yeah.
Right. But I'd already been working on climate change and renewable energy advocacy, and, you know, in connection with some of the work I was doing at Amnesty. I've worked on social justice and social change for the best part of 20 years, and more recently moved to climate because I saw that as such an intersectional issue that, you know, mm-hmm. affected every other issue mm-hmm. I was working on. You can't get justice for anyone or any issue or any part of nature without working on climate. So I'd been working on climate for some years, and then we had an experience here in Ostermere during the Black Summer fires, where not only were we breathing in that acrid smoke that everybody on this podcast can, listening to this podcast can probably relate to, but we also had these surreal experiences where the flying foxes had migrated, we think, from somewhere around Sydney, and we had these flying foxes in their thousands coming out at dusk every day. So there was this orange smoke in the air. We were checking the weather apps. The bats were flying in at dusk. It felt like real kind of end of day stuff. And we were up at the Ostermere fire station getting a briefing where they said, go and get your house ready and get ready to pack up and leave. And I think while this is a very familiar experience for so many Australians, because, you know, 20% of our eastern forests burned in those fires, mm-hmm. and so many people lost, you know, friends, family, homes, all the plants and animals were gone. But this ultimate cognitive dissonance that I experienced, mm-hmm. knowing the climate science, knowing what needed to be done about it, but then also living in this kind of relative suburbia where I walk 10 minutes down to the beach, where we're meant to have, you know, cool, wet forest next door that's meant to calm fire. Mm-hmm. It just broke my brain a little bit. And it was also, you know, super emotional, because one of my daughters got really upset as we were packing up the trailer to get ready to, you know, evacuate if we needed to. And I just, it was clear and present for me what my family would face, what my children would face. This was not the last time that this was going to happen. And so, yeah, that's, I'm sure lots of folks can relate to that kind of moment of crushing despair. And I guess fortunately I then ended up in a pandemic where I had some time to really reflect on it, rather than kind of push that away and distract yourself away from like uncomfortable or painful or charged emotions, and worked through that grief with a group or a project called Good Grief, which is a network and a practice of group conversations that has 10 steps. It's a bit like AA, Right. You don't need to be a massively qualified psychologist or grief counselor to lead these groups. It's not psychological counseling. But I managed to just take some time with others who are feeling similarly to really reflect on your role in the world, your place in the world, the finite nature of life, the ongoing nature of the world that we're in. Mm-hmm. And it made me really reflect on the role I could play. And so that's why I thought about the skills that I had, the networks that I had, and the really privileged position that I have in through my work at Sunrise to see a whole lot of really positive change that's going on and an incredible amount of effort from many different people and groups and organisations through the climate movement. And so that's kind of, I guess the book is a bit realising that role that I can play given the skills and experience and background and connections I have. But then I also wanted to get more connected and see more of what was going on outside of the kind of more stereotypical boundaries of the climate movement. So I went and had a look at climate tech and business and just lots of other sectors and learnt so much about efforts that are happening everywhere where, you know, the kind of advocacy, political, policy making kind of sectors don't often, like, I think there's only so much humans can handle in terms of being able to connect with so many other groups and efforts. But it was a really great way for me to see that I am one of many. And I think people feel very overwhelmed about climate change because they feel like they're by themselves. Mm. And we did a piece of research that landed in mid-2020 called the Climate Compass. And that showed me, as I was processing my climate grief, that there was about 5 million Australians that were so worried about climate that we called them the alarmed, this group. So that group all had all the characteristics in terms of the emotional response to climate change that I've seen many of my colleagues, friends and myself experience. So feelings of uncertainty, anxiousness, exhaustion, frustration, sadness. But that is being felt and experienced on a massive scale in this country. Mm. And we're refreshing the research at the moment, so it'll be interesting to see if that group has grown. But
or if the needles have shifted on any of the benchmarks.
Well, that's right. But also certainly there's been a number of studies both globally and in Australia that shows that levels of climate distress. So there's been a lot of global studies and also studies in Australia that show a growing trend on climate distress, which is the term that kind of groups together eco-anxiety or climate grief. But it's what psychologists prefer to use because it's the term climate distress is actually not a kind of irregular response to a rational state of the world. It's actually a rational response to what is going on.
Reality.
So, you know, rather than feeling, so if you're experiencing some of those charged feelings, you shouldn't feel like you need to go and get some help so you can kind of bed down those feelings and just operate like, you know, things are normal, because they're not. Mm. We are experiencing more frequent and more severe weather events that are fueled by climate change, and we'll see more of them. People are experiencing higher levels of pre-traumatic stress. So, you know, obviously people who are experiencing trauma from those big disaster events, you know, that is a growing trend as well, as we're seeing more of these more frequent, you know, fires, floods and droughts. But there's rising levels of pre-traumatic stress, and there's also bigger levels of climate distress among younger people, and that's shown up in several studies. And so these are really big questions for us to grapple with alongside the really big questions of how we actually going to physically recover from disaster events, how we're going to be prepared and more resilient as a society, but also how we're going to get carbon emissions down because, you know, things will get worse until we, you know, work together really constructively to turn things around. And so that's a lot for people to handle, and it's also a lot for people who already are affected by structural inequality in our current system. So, you know, it's kind of incumbent on me, I felt, with the privilege that I've got and the privilege of the experience of being able to go and take some time to process some of the mental health impacts, to go and then do something constructive with the time that I've got.
Wow, that's incredible. Do you manage your climate grief in a way that is really proactive? Or do you feel like you've been through a phase, you've managed to reckon with it and you've sort of put it to bed and you manage it through systems that are now embedded in your day-to-day ritual? Or do you actually continue to participate in some of those things that you mentioned in the beginning?
I think I definitely went through a phase of actually needing to kind of come to terms with the fact that my life was finite, which is something people don't really like to think about very much. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got a lot to learn from First Nations ways of knowing and being to be able to be comfortable with the fact that your life will end at some point and you'll, you know, the world will be left without you. So that's pretty big stuff, and a lot of people don't want to think about that. But I think once I'd kind of really landed on that, I thought, okay, it made me think about making the most of the time I've got, but that doesn't mean being endlessly productive, you know, in that kind of, you know, industrialized sense. It meant that I was going to think more constructively about what connections am I building? How deep do I want to, you know, engage in the people and the work and the my family connections and my friends? And I'm not perfect at it, but I've made a decision that I don't need to be endlessly productive. I do need to be endlessly looking for ways to have high quality connections with people, and looking at what I can learn from First Nations folks as well, and, you know, without placing a burden on First Nations people. And I received some beautiful gifts from people in the book process, book writing process, that let me reflect more on that. So we can talk about, you know, perhaps some of those lessons a bit later, but the climate grief itself, it ebbs and flows. It's not like I put it to bed and hope it stays, or put it in a locked box and, you know, make sure it stays away. But, you know, if you can actually have someone you can talk to about the way you're feeling, whether that's a professional or your partner or a close friend or in a group, that's what all climate psychologists really recommend, because it allows you to feel solidarity with people who are experiencing the same thing. The most interesting thing I learned through writing the book was from climate psychologist Renee Lertzman. And when we talk about our feelings and not acknowledge the emotional dimension of our lives, that actually helps unlock the prefrontal cortex of our brain. And that's the part of our brain that controls creativity and decision-making and problem-solving. And so if we're ignoring the emotional dimension of our response to the climate crisis, then we are also kind of pushing away the potential that we have to make our best efforts to do something about it. Mm. And it's really challenging, because we kind of need to try and hold on to this kind of, you know, gnawing fear and grief and anxiety that I know a lot of people are experiencing, while also kind of holding maybe everything will be okay and let's try and make a go of it.
Yeah, yeah, so the sense of really hope. Hard. Yeah, my husband calls it hopium, and he says there's no point perpetuating bullshit hopium if it actually means we continue to put our head in the sand. What we actually need to do is harness the hopium with practical action.
Yeah, well, that's right, and that's certainly what I write about in the book. It's called it's a pretty, you know, well-used form of cognitive therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't try and treat the symptoms that you're feeling, the emotional symptoms that you're feeling, but it's basically by taking action and committing to take action, preferably with other people, you'll do better, but you'll also, you know, feel better. So your emotion, like by taking action and feeling like that you're contributing something useful and meaningful, then the byproduct will be that your emotional state will be calmed and those ebbs and flows perhaps won't be so stark.
Mm. Mm. Before I started recording, we were talking very briefly about the oxymoron that sits between the agency of the individual and the ability to have confidence, and I guess some of that hope and solidarity wrapped up in community and togetherness. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you unpicked that?
I certainly found that most people who I spoke to through the book didn't claim that they were the sole instigator or problem solver. They place themselves within a context of community, within a context of relationship, and mutual support in almost pretty much every case. But there was, I think what I try and get to in the book is talking about not only that we don't need the kind of negative definition of hopium, which is, you know, this kind of Pollyanna view of the world, but this idea that a hero is going to come and save us,
right,
is just not a thing. There's a really brilliant woman who's an organisational psychologist and coach called Carol Sanford, who I write about in the book. Mm. She goes and stirs up Fortune 500 companies and gets them to think regeneratively. But, you know, this is not a time for heroes is what she writes about. It's about everybody considering their role. Mm. And when I think about the efforts that you can make as part of, you know, a collective effort that's already happening in your local community or through your workplace or profession, then that's one of the most impactful things you can do because you're leveraging your existing networks mm. and building strong relationships that you'll never know where they lead. A really lovely example of kind of, you know, the incredible nature of community work is probably through the Hunter Jobs Alliance. Like, this is a great story of an unusual alliance of organisations. It only started a couple of years ago, and the Hunter Jobs Alliance was founded by the head of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union and the Labour Environment Action Network, and then they built up to an alliance of 13 environment and union groups. So not usual allies, mm-hmm. but basically they saw after the 2019 election that they wanted to end the climate wars because it was, you know, politics was kind of tearing apart relationships and the potential to reimagine a future in the Hunter, which is, you know, Newcastle is the world's largest coal port. You know, millions of tons of coal are exported through there every year. And, you know, rather than letting the community become kind of collateral damage in a political war for power, some pretty key players in the local community's political debate decided to get together and see what they could solve together in that place-based sense. And they've managed to help get a commitment from Rio Tinto to repower the aluminium smelter at Tomago with renewables by around the end of this decade. They've helped to get, you know, $20 million for a transition fund from the New South Wales government. And they've basically ended the conversation in the Hunter around whether it's the environment versus jobs mm. because everybody, when they really think about it, knows that you need both to have a secure and thriving future for that region, which has gone through, you know, highs and lows. It's been a real boom and bust economy. And I can say that with some reflection because it's where I grew up. Mm. I grew up on Macquarie. And so the choices that individuals can make to either be part of a fight and a destructive debate comes down to sometimes individuals, because individuals sometimes have, you know, particular positions of influence and power. But the choices that were made by those groups to have a constructive conversation rather than a destructive culture war have been really fundamental in that part of the world. And there's plenty of other examples where work like that is going on. So it's a really encouraging way to see how people can come together around a place and around a kind of common concern and common cause and get some really wonderful things done that will help the community weather the transition, because we know that the transition away from fossil fuels is going to happen. The question is just, you know, how quickly will it occur now?
Yeah, and acceptance of that inevitability seems to be washing pretty strongly over most of us, and the power of the collective is always going to be stronger than the ego of the individual.
Yeah, that's right. I just love, there's so many stories just on personal connection that have been really wonderful to consider, because one of the really interesting things I learned through writing the book is that, you know, we're in the middle of an epidemic of loneliness in this country. You know, 44% of Australians report that they regularly feel lonely. Mm. And they're also, when you're feeling lonely, you're far less likely to want to talk to anybody about it. So it's kind of, if you're feeling lonely, and loneliness is actually more prevalent amongst younger people aged 18 to 25 than among much older people, according to a few reports that I looked at through researching the book. So, yeah, if you're feeling lonely, you're less likely to go and talk to anyone about it. You're more likely to withdraw. And so if you're thinking about people feeling alienated in their own communities, that can continue to spiral. So I guess it's incumbent on all of us to try and build good connections so that, you know, we can start more virtuous cycles around community connection and collective.
Mm. And how are you doing some of that?
I'm not great at it. I started by, I think, you know, nobody's perfect. It's always one of those things. I've started by actually volunteering at my local food co-op during the pandemic. I was a kind of occasional volunteer there, but during the pandemic they closed the shop and we were doing online orders fulfilling. Mm-hmm. So, and I said, well, I've got a little bit more time. You know, how about I come and help out? And that's been a great way for me to get to know people in my local community who have similar interests and, you know, really like great food. And, you know, it was kind of just turning up to be someone who can help rather than having to be an expert in something was really awesome as well. And then, you know, I ended up kind of helping the board with its strategy and using some of the hardcore skills that I've got to help with some of the more work I'd be more usually doing. But I really like just helping out in the shop and talking to people as they come in and stuff like that. So that's been great. That's probably been the biggest way I've tried to make a contribution, apart from just meeting people socially. But I have linked up with a few local efforts through writing the book as well. So that's been really great. So, you know, Yael Stone, who's a performer and actor, but she's also a really amazing climate activist. She started an effort in our neighbourhood called High Neighbour, which aims to build renewables projects and basically get fossil fuel workers, give them the option to get funded to retrain in other industries. So they've got a, you know, off-ramp from that industry. And, you know, reconnected with Mithra Cox, who I knew some years ago, but she's now a Wollongong councillor. So, yeah, it's interesting how sometimes it can be useful having a project to help you connect to your local community as well, or just joining a local group. So, yeah, I'm not perfect. I, you know, would love to have more time, and probably when you're trying to, you know, get a book launched into the world is not the best time to talk about how much time you're, you know, wondering to chat to people about their gardens. But,
no,
you know,
it most definitely is not. You're not actually doing anything together, we can, or to future study in my case at this time. Yeah, I mean, it's just a moment in time, isn't it? It's a snapshot, and this is what you're focused on, and soon that will change and you'll go back to a new normal. You mentioned before that writing the book served a whole heap of lessons, and you said, let's dive into that. Let's do that now.
So I think the biggest lesson from the book that, you know, means most to me is, I'll probably get quite emotional when I talk about it. I don't know why, but I do. As I had this wonderful conversation with a woman called Nola Turner Jensen, who's a Wiradjuri woman who is using her skills to remap the Wiradjuri language as associated directly to place. And she's really well skilled in what's called Sky World Totemic Ancestry. So she knows a lot about totems and how they work. What was amazing about this conversation, you know, well, a couple of conversations, was that she essentially gave me, and through the book, everybody permission to go and try and think about some of the practices that First Nations folk have been taught and absorbed over thousands of years. And it's okay for us to be exposed to them. It's okay for us to connect to country. I think People who care deeply about justice and climate justice feel like that they have no right to be on this country. Sometimes I certainly feel like that at times.
Yeah,
you know, my ancestors colonized this country. You know, some of them were convicts, some of them were soldiers. God knows what, you know, they were responsible for, you know, in terms of dispossession or violence towards First Nations communities. But we had these beautiful conversation about just getting to know the country that you're on, thinking about the relationship that you can be in with, you know, the birds that fly by or the plants in your local area, thinking about these parts of your local landscape and people as well that you can help to care for. And it's very simple, but if you think about the way they think about it, the way totems work, and I'm not at all qualified to talk about this in detail, but my understanding of it is, you know, you think about a bird that flies by that's your totem and you say that's your ancestor, you go, oh, g'day, ancestor. You know, so thinking about that living creatures as being in relationship with us all the time helps reset the way we should be collaborating with nature, the way we should be protecting plants and animals, not just thinking about how we can use them for our own purposes as humans. Massive lesson. Thank you.
There's an ancestor.
Yeah. And then so that was the kind of more spiritual, reflective, massive lesson for me, that like I was given permission, and it's such a gift, to think about how I can build some of those practices into my everyday, which also is a gratitude practice, right? It makes you feel grateful of the living creatures that are around you, which, you know, and everyone knows, well, a lot of us know that doing daily gratitude practice can really help with your mental health anyway. So that was a kind of quite individual, like rich lesson for me. But I think the bigger lesson that I really reflected on was around networks. So I managed to do this research. So I had a really great lesson from a Penn State University academic called Damon Centola, and he's a social scientist who specializes in behavior change and how it spreads. And the big lesson for me was that you don't have to be a celebrity to spread behavior change. In fact, that's not how it happens. If you want to spread information, if you want to get the word out about a thing happening, yep, celebrities are your go-to. They've got big megaphones. It turns people's attention. But when it comes to behavior change, it's ordinary folks that are often on the periphery of social networks that are, once behavior change starts flowing through a social network and creating new social norms, people on the peripheries of these networks, if they're also in another network, that's when behavior change can leap to another network. And so that's why Twitter leapt from the west coast of the US to Boston really quickly, because there were networks of academics who were all hearing about Twitter. It wasn't Oprah that set off Twitter. It was these social networks that saw it leap. So it made me think about the power of, you know, everyday folks in networks that can be spreading the word about what they're doing, spreading the word about initiatives that people can join, demonstrating the benefits of some of the changes that they're seeing, experiencing or doing that can have greatest power, because the people that are close to you in your social networks are the people you're more likely to listen to when it comes to actually changing your behaviour. So massive lesson, because it made me think about the power of influence everybody has and for people to be thinking about how to make a meaningful difference on climate change, thinking about how you're engaging and talking to your networks, thinking about the influence you might have, particularly when we've got particular power structures in our society. Some people at the moment do have more capacity to influence more change more quickly. Mm. Think about where you can do what you can do where you are, which I think was one of the biggest lessons for me.
In your sphere of influence. Yeah, I call them edge dwellers, and in my work at Sustainable Table we refer to them as edge dwellers, because even though they're right out there on the edges, they're the ones that will actually, they're sowing seeds that we can then water and nourish and help flourish as they grow. And so they're actually the ones that we need to be taking a little bit more notice of, those that are right out there on the edge.
That's right. And can I say a little bit more about the other lesson is around the power of conversation. So What I've learned from working with lots of climate activists and organisations over the years is that people often feel like they need to go and, you know, find the hardest conversation they can have and try and convince that person because that's the biggest problem. Like, let's go and take on the climate denier over Christmas lunch. And you may have seen this play out. Or take that person on social media and go and have a whole comment war, you know, when someone posts some disinformation. But actually, for people who are bona fide climate deniers, no point wasting your energy on them. It's really much more transformational to have a constructive conversation with someone who's concerned, interested, but just is a little unsure on things and what they could do. So there's some advice in the book on how to have a more constructive climate conversation with people who might fall into that category. But, you know, if you've got your, you know, Uncle Bob who's sitting around the Christmas dinner table and they're an outright climate denier, you might want to talk a little bit about the cost savings, you know, by installing solar panels or something like that.
But really focus on the custard.
Focus on the custard and also preserve the relationship. Like, yeah, we actually need good relationships in our lives to, you know, face what's coming. And, you know, people can deny climate change if they want, but it's really a much smaller majority than people might believe. It's a very small percentage of Australian society. Most people, you know, around 70% of Australian society believe that, you know, climate change is a thing and they're worried about it, but it's the degree of worry which is what's kind of exposed
the variation.
Yeah,
I feel like, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about this with you because I would love to understand your perspective on it. I feel like there has been a deep chasm form in the last 2 to 3 years around belief bases, and I feel like sometimes jumping that chasm to have that conversation with people who you ordinarily could have functioned alongside, even with differing beliefs, is getting greater and it's harder. It's you know, having just got back from the States, there were definitely conversations where I backed out really quickly, thinking I can't navigate this chasm. I can't get to where you sit, and you don't want to be where I sit. And so, does that mean that we can have nothing to do with each other? And that's, I believe, not naturally people's inclination. People are actually, you know, humanized and collective beings, and ordinarily we are reliant on one another, and we're better at being together than apart. But it feels like there has been this cultural shift, certainly in the Western world, where we've divided beyond return. What do we do with that culturally? How do we rebuild that? I often say that in my mind the answer is in ritual, where the doing can replace the talking, and it's about human interrelationships rather than, you know, talking about the values or the complex belief systems that each of us hold as individuals, and just be alongside each other and dig that hole or plant that seed or share that pie or whatever it is that you're doing through day-to-day existence. But what are your words of advice on that?
What I did see through writing the book were just some beautiful examples of very simple activities that have rebuilt communities. That the most pressing example is in Cobargo, which is on the south coast of New South Wales, and it was a town that was decimated in the Black Summer fires. And, you know, there was some community consultation meetings set up that didn't apparently go amazingly well. But so some local folks, Deborah Summer and her partner David, they are skilled in something called the art of hosting, which is a kind of global movement on how to have really constructive group conversations and interactions. And they just decided to set up Cobargo community catch-ups, which was in the local hall. And they, you know, put the sign out and got some activities ready, and 100 people turned up at the first meeting. And this was very soon after the fires calmed. It was in February 2020. And from those conversations, which had to move to Zoom and all the kinds of things that, you know, the pandemic made to complicate our lives, they still managed to create these incredible, incredible projects. They've got a tool library which has got some kit that you just cannot believe. They've had art projects and community gardens. They're rebuilding most of the main street that was destroyed by the fires. And a lot of those buildings will be cooperatively owned. People have donated property. They're building a fire refuge that will also be a community centre. They've raised millions of dollars. And I think the doing has helped build and solidify relationships, helped a lot of people with trauma. I don't want to pretend that it's all solved, because there's a lot of people who are still don't have permanent homes. There's been a lot of trauma and a lot of struggle for that community. It's a very tiny community, about 800 people. But it shows the power of just bringing people together to talk and to find common purpose, rather than looking for point scoring or division or one-upmanship, because those kinds of individualist practices are the things that tear us apart. And, you know, I think we've been taught for so long that success is only individual, because that serves the economy. It's just not what we need at this moment in our history. So I think I'm quite optimistic when we think we've got a prime minister now who seems to be, you know, saying more about consensus than about division at this point. And we have our first climate bill, which is not nearly what's required, but it's, you know, we've got a target that's been adopted by the parliament. This was unthinkable even 12 months ago. I feel like there is a spirit of cooperation that is possible to tap at the political level, but it will be really realised at community level, and showing politicians that communities are connected and united and want them to do more is going to be really transformational. So I think there's all these things are interrelated, but, you know, before I overwhelm all of your listeners by thinking about everything everywhere all at once, you know, it's just thinking about the role that you can play in that system, rather than thinking you need to change the whole system yourself, is pretty fundamental message of the book.
Yeah, sow a seed. So the seed that you can most easily sow today, where you are.
Even if you're not a gardener, not a very good one.
Yeah. I didn't mean that literally. I mean, so your type of seed. You have kids, and I've no doubt they have watched and observed as you've undertaken these lessons, as you wrote your book. What advice do you have for them on a day-to-day basis when they say, look, I don't know what to do with this piece of knowledge, and I don't know how to navigate the next tricky stage?
I guess that's another thing I actually didn't write in the book, but kind of realised after the book was published, is that people often ask me in all facets of life, what can I do? You know, it's the job, because I work on a really big issue. What can I do? And it's just not the right question. It's about, you know, what's next? What's the next thing I do? So, you know, if the kids have a problem where they see a system is not working, or a structure at their school, or, you know, elsewhere is not working, I go, okay, what are you going to do about it? And they go, I don't know. And it's like, well, you break it down into like, well, what's the next step you can take? And I think that's probably pretty fundamental for us in our busy lives, because we think we need to have to do this massive amount of additional work to be able to make a difference. Whereas really, if you're thinking about what you're really great at and what you love doing, you think about the need, and that's obvious and pressing, but also thinking about the networks you're in, you can usually, you know, think about your next step. And I've got a list in the book and on my website. You can find it at climateactionstartshere.com, with a lot of ideas of groups you can join. So you don't have to reinvent things. You just join things and, you know, see what the next invitation is that comes your way to take action and meet people. There's beautiful networks springing up everywhere. I think Australian Parents for Climate Action is a really brilliant example of, you know, they've got 16,000 members around the country and groups everywhere, and they're connecting people, you know, who are carers and grandparents and parents of young and older children with their common concern. So, but it's also a way to be social and meet people and connect. So I don't know, I'm feeling like there's intersecting threads in the way I think about action on climate, which is how are we making sure we're well connected, that we've got good relationships, but we're also doing work that feels meaningful to us without adding another 25, 50 hours a week when most people are working a lot. Like we are working a lot.
Or adding to the emotional load.
Yeah. You know, think about what's the next thing you could do that, you know, you'd be interested in doing that could make a difference. Because like my daughter asked me, well, how can I do something on climate? Like, you know, what should I do for a job? And I said, well, really, you can do almost anything, because everything's going to be about climate change. within not, it's almost like within months rather than within years. So there's loads of opportunities to get involved. And the more people that do, the more that we've got more chance of tipping the system to more accelerated decarbonisation. And that's super exciting. That's when I get really excited about it, because the whole world is shifting. We're in a fundamental moment. And thinking about what you're going to do next is simpler than I think it was even 5 or 10 years ago.
And what are you going to do next?
Ooh, interesting question. I'm going to get to the end of the year and, you know, hope to get as many people exposed to some of the messages in the book. So I'm hoping that they're useful to people. I think what I'm most interested in is how different parts of our society can be more connected, actually, because, you know, thinking about some of the skills and relationships and incredible people there are that I know well that are working through climate advocacy, through policy and politics and campaigning, and how their skills could be really useful to people working in climate tech. Or, you know, I think about the Landcare Network, and there's all of these networks that are working, I think, a little bit in silos because, you know, people find their community. And but let's thinking about the connective tissue between these different movements and organisations and how we can, you know, create those network effects that means we can, you know, get more done more quickly is what I'm probably most interested in. But also, my day work is actually helping to accelerate the energy transition so we can replace all of our coal power stations with renewables, and making sure there's, you know, really solid support for workers and communities through that shift is, you know, really important for our country. It's important for the world. It's important for climate justice. So that's kind of part of my work as well. So I don't think of my work just doesn't seem to end, because I find it enriching. I've got great relationships, and I'll just be doing more of that, I suppose.
We talk a lot about what enough actually looks like and how the vast majority of us in these developed countries actually have enough, and actually the more than enough that we have actually erodes those who don't have enough and their ability to come to the same level. So it would be amazing to know what your enough looks like. And also, what's your definition of success? You talked about it before. You said we need to reframe success. I would love to know what your definition really is.
So interesting. This book's brought really incredible things to my life so far, just through the process of writing it. But I managed to reconnect with my great aunt yesterday, who I hadn't seen for about 17 years. Mm. She's 100 years old and she's turning 101 within the week. And when you think about someone who's lived that long and is a happy, engaged member of society, it really kind of blows your mind a little bit. And I'm reflecting on that. My definition of success is actually to have a healthy, enjoyable life that's connected to nature and connected to people, and to make sure my family and children are well. That's it. Everything else kind of makes that happen a bit more easily, you know, when it all boils down to it. But anyway, my great aunt Betty,
of course,
who I had lunch with yesterday, she said the biggest lesson in life she's learned is the ability to laugh at yourself. So not taking everything so seriously is super important. Like, you can't go around, you know, self-flagellating about climate change all the time, because, you know, folks in the book said again and again, you know, in these interviews I did, it was like, well, what's the point of having a great planet if you've got no one to share it with?
Yeah.
You know, the very, you know, what we're trying to protect is environment, but that sustains us, and in turn we can sustain it. And it just, like, it just made me think we just actually need to have fun. You've got to enjoy the world that you're in. Otherwise, what's the point of saving it? And I think enough is that for me. And, you know, I'm captive to all the distractions of modern life. You know, I like my iPhone. I love a really excellent pair of shoes sometimes, you know, And I sometimes feel like we're not allowed to engage in any of that if you're going to be a perfect climate person. But imperfection is the beauty of human nature, and imperfect is going to be the journey that we go on when it comes to solving this problem. The Climate Council recommends that for Australia to play its role and contribute its fair share to decarbonisation, we need to get to 75% emissions reduction by 2030 and zero emissions by 2035. That's not very far away, and that's for Australia to play its fair share. And Australia is in a unique position with, incredible renewable power resources that can fundamentally shift not only our own economy but the global economy. We've got more potential here to, use less energy. We've got, when we shift to renewables, we'll be using more efficient energy. Electrifying everything, as Saul Griffith writes, means that we will use less overall energy to deliver the same kind of results that we need to kind of keep our modern lives going. So I think having enough is really fundamentally, about, having great relationships and, a healthy body and all of those kinds of things. But we need to shift away from it means less of everything. It means action on climate for me means more of the things that we love in terms of the relationships and a clean environment, but also thinking about things as being plentiful, like the sun coming up every day, is the way we need to think about how we shift, thinking about the benefits that can come from the shift rather than what we'll lose. Because humans don't like losing things, we don't like change, but thinking about what it can bring to our lives and what it can bring to our jobs and careers and our communities and our economy is, I think, the solution from my perspective, because we've got more chance of making those economies work for people.
I think that is a beautiful way to end.